Yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music on the Air and in Your Ear. We are the Metal Nerds. I am Mo. That's Brett.
Hello, Nerd.
Nerd. Mr. Brett Podcast. King of the Casters over there. And we have Mac with us. Oh, there he is.
That's Mr. Nerd to you.
Well, Jason McMaster of Dangerous Toys gave us that nickname. And you're damn straight we're going to own it.
There you go. If the shoe fits.
That's right. It definitely does. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the star of the show. We're just the conduits for his stardom.
That loosely, is... loosely termed.
That is Ron Young, lead singer, Little Seas of Ron. Thanks for coming back. What happened last time we had a hard out?
Oh my God. I'm talking to you guys on my phone, and my phone is lighting up with text from my wife going, call me, it's an emergency. And so I call her on the phone, and I'm building this ranch farm that I live on. And she was out walking with my dogs and these feral cats that we have living on the property, which of course now we feed. So they're kind of not even getting to be very feral. My big mastiffs encountered them in a closed, tightly closed space. And the cat lost that little encounter and was killed right in front of my wife, and the dogs were incredibly proud, and she was incredibly traumatized, and I had to go down and deal with that. So it's not always hookers and blow, kids. So,
we'll probably get there too. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's also roadies.
Yeah, well, they're the ones doing all the hookers and blow. Yeah,
you're too busy working.
Exactly right.
You sent an email about it, and it ended with, this story sounds much better if you replace the word roadie with the and cat with the word roadie with cat. With hooker, I think.
Yeah.
Mastiff with the word roadie and the word cat with hooker.
So, exactly. It's the Mad Libs of life, yeah.
Yeah, we're doing that now for everything.
exactly.
In fact, I have a little bit we'll probably get to later. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. Trust me.
I'm looking forward to it.
So but, now it's going to be our turn to entertain you. So.
Excellent.
And we're going to get into all sorts of stuff. But first, Brett had a story. Like, you were literally got off the air after he had a story he's been waiting. I don't know. Look, how many years to tell him, Brett?
It's got to be at least like 25 years.
Wow. It's got to be good if you've held on to it for that long.
Not really.
Well, you know, it's probably underwhelming after this long, but I find it amusing, at least. So anyways, because we've been fans of Little Caesar since Little Caesar started. So, I mean, we were 18 when the first album dropped, and we loved it. And then after Influence came out, then... It was that point where you talked about last episode where you kind of fell off the map for a while.
Yeah.
because when I list like my top 10 favorite vocals in hard rock, yours is in that top 10.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. And so I could sit there for, like, I would just sit there on the internet at the time looking for Ron Young. And I was looking for more music from you. And so then, as I was doing that, I was on eBay. And I happened to see this CD, because this was back in the day when you could actually really get CDs and off of eBay. But, you know,
right,
and the CD was from Ron Young, and it was 37 cents. And I was thinking, this is awesome. I didn't know you had a solo album.
And you won't be overpaying.
Neither did I. Did you get a gospel record?
Well, no. But the funny thing is that I go onto AllMusic, and so I search Ron Young, and it comes up with the Little Caesar albums, and then it comes up with this album, and I'm like, well, okay, it must be right. So I order this album for 37 cents, and it comes. And I look at it, and yeah, like, the guy's a balding, older, white guy. And I'm like, oh, no, this isn't,
It could have actually been you, Brett.
Wow, he's gone downhill. Yeah.
That was fast. Yeah, like for a tattooed, you know, biker guy.
Dude. Rode hard and put away wet. Yep.
So I'm all disappointed. And so I think, okay, well, I bought the damn thing. I might as well put it in. So I plunk it in the CD player. And needless to say, one of the songs actually wound up as the song that I used in my wedding. But so it all worked out.
But what was it?
Oh, the song?
No, just the guy. And who was this balding fat guy?
I don't know. I can't find anything about him because everything about this album everywhere points to you.
Yeah. Well, listen, 37 cents.
Hey, did you get your cut of that, Ron?
No, I didn't. I've got my lawyers working on it. You know, hopefully he went and got a toupee and will keep my image going. See, I used to come across all the time. There was a gospel singer that was putting out CDs.
Yeah, and I found those recently.
Yeah, but he's African American descent, so it's pretty obvious that it wasn't me gone to hell. So,
well, yeah, and on eBay there was no picture to the CD, so I was just I was going off of AllMusic, and then I sent an angry email to AllMusic saying you should fix this, and they never did.
Did I tell you guys about the angry emails I get at the Little Caesar site?
No.
I'd say at least once a week. Now I don't know if these are up by you guys, but we have Little Caesar's Pizza, You know, this is, again, one of the classic Spinal Tap moments of my life where I named this band after the old gangster film. And Geffen Records doesn't tell us till like 3 weeks before the record's coming out going, you know, there's a national pizza chain outside of California with the same band name. I'm like, no, we didn't know this. Why didn't you tell us this? We were changing the name of the band. Oh, well, we already did the artwork and everything, so let's just go with it. And it's like, oh, great. So, but anyway, at least once a week, I get an email on the Little Caesar band website complaining about their pizza. And I'm like, how dumb does someone have to be to go on the internet and it comes up and here's a skull with our logo and they click contact and they complain that their pizza was cold or there wasn't enough pepperoni on it. And I respond to them. I'm sincerely sorry that your pizza sucked. We strive really hard to, you know, keep our quality. And it's really kind of entertaining. I even send them out to the other guys. Hey, could you respond to this lady? She's really upset about her two-for-one pizza deal.
Do you ever offer her free pizza next time she comes in? Just mention your name?
Well, this is the interesting thing. When we were on Geffen and we finished the record and we were waiting for their great marketing plan, and weeks were going by. We're like, when the hell are they going to sit down with us and tell us how they're going to try to sell this record? So they finally called and said, okay, we want to market me. I go down there with Jimmy Iovine and our day-to-day manager, Tony Ferguson, and we're sitting here with all the big wigs at Geffen, and their head of promotion goes, this is what we're going to do. On every Little Caesar's pizza, we're going to give a $5 off coupon. And I started laughing. I said, that's really funny. No, seriously. And they were dead serious, like as if anybody randomly who orders a pizza is going to like our band and want to use this $5 coupon. This was yet again another example to me where I knew this was not going to go well. So that was one of their brilliant ideas. So, yeah, in my part-time for fun, I answer angry customer service emails for a pizza chain.
So what are some of the other great ideas they had for marketing you guys? Because we have heard some doozies, like some stories. I think who was it, Brett? It was it Derek Davis talking about them giving out for his song. I can't remember what song it was for Babylon AD, but it was they were giving out condoms.
That's right. It was Psychedelic Sex Reaction, yes, and they were going to give out condoms.
Yeah, they were going to give out glow-in-the-dark condoms.
That's at least practical, and then you can see it coming in the dark, you know? I don't know. I mean, at least there's some market value to that. Ours was just going to be a piece of paper that was going to get thrown away on a bad pizza. So, You know, they didn't have any great ideas, but we got a phone call from The Gap, and The Gap wanted to use us. It was going to be us and actually my friend Catherine Bigelow, the director, and one or two other really cool up-and-coming people for their new jeans ad campaign. And they were going to plaster us on every billboard and bus stop all across the United States and the world. And Geffen turned around and turned it down. Annie Leibovitz was going to be the photographer.
Oh, my
God. Wow.
And they turned it down saying, you know, we think it's going to be a little, pardon the term, cheesy. So pizza's okay, but doing a national ad campaign, being listed amongst really cool artists in all these different fields on every, I mean, literally a month later, I'm looking up at every billboard in LA and every bus stop, and there's all these photographs of these people, and we could have been one of them, and Geffen turned it down as being a bad idea. So, yet again, you know, you wonder why there's no more music business. It's because these people were the ones running it for too long, you know?
It seems unfathomable that all the stories we've heard, and they're all about ridiculous decisions that the record companies made, where it seems really obvious that they should go the other way.
But it's because you guys are, it just seems like it's because you guys are just a commodity. I mean, if they're making a ton of money off somebody, they don't care if they lose money on you, and they're just going to throw all their attention to somebody else.
And that's basically it. It's a nepotistic business of something that really has no intrinsic value other than what certain entities say that it is. And it's a business where people fell upward all the time, and it wasn't really necessarily merit-based because it is so intangible. Every record contract says that you can't hold them to any obligation of sales or numbers or performance, but they have all of these requirements that you have to fulfill. And it's funny because I read an article once in the LA Times where what the writer did was he took a standard recording contract for any new artist or even established artist and took out all the terms that sort of alluded to that it was music business and put in like soap powder, just a general product for distribution. And they sent it out to like the 20 top lawyers in the country. And every single one of them wrote back and said, if you sign this contract, you're out of your mind. I've never seen a more one-sided, exploitive, and completely just terrible, you know, offer for a deal. And I would turn it down instantly. Don't even entertain it. And this is the stuff that – these are the contracts that everybody kind of was forced to sign since, you know, 1950 when the record companies were taking advantage of people. And so it just kind of became the established thing. And – you know, in the days when there was so much money getting thrown around, if you were one of the bands that hit it out of the park, it was a tremendous amount of money being made. It wasn't from record sales. In fact, I posted about this today on Facebook. I know guys that sold 2-3 million records. And according to their record company, they still owe them like $400,000, $500,000, even after selling millions of units. Because every single thing that they did in order to promote the band went back onto their tab. So every time an A&R guy took a first-class flight at a first-class hotel to come see the band, boom, there's $7,000 of – well, you have to sell a $15 CD at a wholesale price of $5, and you get 10 cents on the dollar, so you get 50 cents for every record. You got to sell a lot of records to pay back that $7,000, and that doesn't count any tour support or the messenger fees or the advertising costs or the promotional copies that they send out. Every single one of those things goes on your tab, and you're paying it back at like 12 cents on the dollar. So you're never, ever going to see a dime of revenue. So that's why all these bands go for merch and for touring, because it's not about the record, you know? It's crazy.
Billy Childs, who's the bassist for Britney Fox, he told us that he thinks his theory is it was kind of the same thing, that they were in a situation where they're selling a lot of records. And, you know, he was out there with his AR guy and he's on tour and he's telling him, he's like, where's the money? We're selling all this stuff. And they kept going, what are you talking worried about? You're a rock star. Look at all the women. Look at all the, right, look at all the, exactly, the look at all the alcohol. Look at the
shiny object. Get the ball. Go get the ball. Go
yeah,
get the ball.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. He said it's a conspiracy theory. He thinks that they can blind you for so long with that stuff, that thinking, hey, you're a rock star, it's going to come. And the good things, the women and the drugs and the alcohol or whatever it is, to the point that when you turn around and realize that it didn't work out, they've already moved on from you.
Yeah, that was basically it. I mean, listen, it took me a long time to get to a point where I could stand back and look at what I've chosen to do for my life. And it's like, okay, you want to be a performer. You want to get on a stage and pour your heart out and have a whole bunch of random strangers validate you by clapping and cheering for you. And this is what gets you up in the morning and gets you out the door. And if you don't think it's working for you tonight, tomorrow I could be a completely different guy. And I move on to a completely new set of people. Just all of that, when you look at it, is incredibly dysfunctional. So if this is what you've chose to do for a living, anything other than the reward of making music as being an artist is usually pretty, you know, if you look at it from an adult's, you know, scale, is pretty kind of screwed up. And so if you're 21 years old and you're having like all of these women throw themselves at you and there's all these drugs and every town you go to, it's a party, man. And you're the center of attention. And, you know, if you're not getting any accurate answers as to why you can't pay for your shared apartment back home with the bass player from some other band, you don't really push it. You just keep taking the ride. And then one day you wake up and you realize, I got to grow up and actually like try to start getting a permanent roof over my head, maybe a permanent relationship. And you know what? At that point, man, generally the train has left the station, you know, unless you're Def Leppard or Aerosmith or, you know, and those are the, you know, those are what I call the lottery winners. You know, everybody's going to win the lottery every day. And there's probably a million bands that you've heard of that personally you think are really kind of crappy and they've sold 12 million records. Commerce and art are two different things. So it's all relative, but not many people made that kind of revenue that actually can live on into retirement. And a lot of them are still out there in a van, stuffed into spandex pants and dyeing their hair black. hoping that they can, you know, fill a theater or even a club. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked to a lot of people, and there is a lot of similarities, but, you know, and I think a lot of the biggest similarities are just the fact that most of them say they really can't stop because they can't, there's not enough that, like, it's so ingrained in their personality now to keep going out there and performing that you have to keep doing it. It's really rare to find the person who has basically, who, you know, released an album, released a few albums, and then just decided to stop cold.
But yeah, right, become a plumber at 44, you know? It's yeah. Like, yeah, it's difficult. And you know what, it's... You know, I'm really grateful, like I say, that I didn't become as big as they promised me or kind of, you know, sort of enticed me with the potential of being, because I could very well be one of those guys. And I have the deepest respect for those guys that are out there doing it, because combined with, you know, they do what I do. They love it. They absolutely, it's part of their soul. It's part of their makeup. They have to do it for them to wake up in the morning and feel rewarded as a human being. And I totally respect and relate to that. But the thing is that the conditions of their life are such that them and their other bandmates or the one or two other original members have to do that for a commercial side of things. And it's so difficult, man. It's really difficult. And the things that you wind up having to do, the corners that you wind up having to cut, the resources that you have to work with becomes more and more limited. And, it, you know, as you get older and older and, you know, staying in lousy hotel rooms, eating badly, sleeping badly, doing enough shows in a week to generate enough revenue is incredibly taxing physically. And, you know, I've got a whole group of friends that I communicate with on Facebook who are out there doing it. We commiserate about all this stuff. It's like, you know, we all travel with steroids and antibiotics, you know, the singers do. And all these other guys are like going to try to get massages and chiropractors and acupuncturists to get the sciatic nerves to calm down so they can get on the stage. And, you know, when you were 24, it was, you know, if you just found some cute girl to take you home and she fed you some lasagna and let you sleep with her, it was like, cha-ching, hit the lottery. But it kind of, that goes away once you start getting older and it just doesn't work anymore.
Now, was there ever any interest on your part, I guess, because we know some guys who've gone across to Europe and the like, and that's kind of where they live now, because that's where they're doing most of their projects, because they can get work singing on any number of different bands' albums over there. But you really, I mean, it's Little Caesar. I mean, yeah, you had a little bit of other stuff. You've appeared on a couple of compilation albums, but it's not really, it's not a lot. Was there ever that interest in your mind to move somewhere else, or was it always just going to be this?
No, you know, it's, one day I will write a book, but then I wake up and realize that if nobody buys my music, who's going to buy my book? So, you know, it's like, wow, this is pointless. You know, it's just like, you know, I was in the Red Hot Chili Peppers for 2 months in 1986. That didn't work out. I was the singer on Slash's solo record. That didn't work out. I did a super group with basically Whitesnake with me singing. That didn't work out. So,
but it was great.
It was great. Don't get me wrong. Musically, it's great. But, you know, this is the kind of weird thing. Is it, at some point, you know, you sit there and you stop trying to come up with these great ideas of what it is that's going to make you have a career. Because, you know, while all of that's going on, music is changing. And then after all the music changed, then the music business changed. And I know so many guys that you know, it's like the guys in Sons of Apollo, you know, Derek Sherinian and Jeff Scott Soto and all those guys. It's a super group. And I'm looking at their touring schedule and I talk to them online and I'm like, they love every second of it. And they're really excited because they've got this vibrance and they've got this excitement and they've got this push going on. You know, and then on the other side of the coin, they're like, man, my wife is really pissed because I'm leaving for this amount of time. And, you know, it's a totally different realm and a different set of circumstances now for so many components of this, you know.
Well, because like last week, I mean, it's interesting because last week we talked to Jeff as well, but we also were able to go to see Udo Dirkschneider of Accept live, and he's got you know, a fairly sizable club tour, and it's the first time that I can actually recall him coming through Canada and where we live in Calgary. And so I know it's hard when you're touring to put together enough shows. So in his case, it seems like this is almost a once in a lifetime yeah, you know, a thing for us to go see. You know, how hard is it then in your case to put together?
Oh, it's like really that? Hard. I mean, all day long, I'm trying to articulate to people and make them understand. They go, "Well, come to Tampa." Oh yeah, like, well, let me just throw the guys on a plane and we'll come down to Tampa and we'll play in your little club to like 85 people, and then we'll come back home. No, it just doesn't work that way. And for us, we pick and choose. You know, because we're not doing this 24/7, and we try to make music credibly and professionally and responsibly, but, you know, we allot the time to write, we allot the time to gig, we allot the time to record, and we put our whole heart and soul into it when we do that. And it's, you know, it isn't just, well, let's just get in a van and we'll start driving across Canada and we'll play wherever it is that'll give us a connecting date. Because that's the thing, the logistics of it are really, really hard because, you know, people don't realize that the venues that are going under faster than the bands go under are having a really, really tough time keeping their doors open. You know, if somebody who's, say, in their 40s has, you know, they got kids and a job and they want to see a show, they want to go out, but, you know, oh, man, I'm going to be up late, and I'm going to have to get a babysitter, or, you know, and they know that their friend's going to be there and they're going to pick up their phone and Facebook Live it. They'll sit in their underwear at home and watch a couple of songs on the internet and feel like they were there and don't have the expense, don't have the aggravation, don't have the obligation to get out there and do it. And this is what the venues are facing and the bands are facing. And so it's harder and harder every day to make it so that people come out. And there's certain people that are really hot in one place and not that hot in another, or the weather. Like we just were in the UK, was the worst snowstorm in 35 years. Hmm. We're following a salt truck up the highway just to get to the next town, and we played to 8 people because the roads were closed. So you were like, this is like Spinal Tap. We're dressed. I'm singing in a winter coat and a scarf inside because the club was built, you know, the building was from 1682, you know, so... It takes 4 days just to heat the place up. So it's all bizarre, but all of this stuff kind of adds together. And when people want to talk about, well, what's happening to music, I don't think they really understand how pervasive and wide it is, where maybe the record sales aren't there and this and that, but there's also the live situation, the expenses, gas prices, you know, how much these clubs are willing to take a chance to give you a guaranteed amount of money so that you can budget things out. And, you know, all of these things, it's really, really expensive to do. And the fans would love to go see it. But, you know, unless it's something that can do 500 to 1500 seats, it's really, really expensive to get out there and do it. And for a lot of bands, they just break even, or they, you know, some of them lose money, but they just do it because they love to do it. At least that's the way it is for us. You know, we're breaking even, and we got to work our ass off for about a month straight, doing 5 shows a week, sometimes 6 shows a week. And I'm not a kid anymore, man, doing 6 shows. And then the problem is we get out there and they keep calling for more songs, and the next thing you know, we're played for 2 hours straight, and I'm like, oh, crap, I got to do this again tomorrow, you know? And it's rough. It's really rough. I still love it to bits, though, you know?
I'm interested in merchandise, because now in the case, we've seen a lot of different bands, and in some cases you go to the club and there's virtually nothing. There's like maybe a t-shirt, and obviously I'm sure that that you as the band have to buy all the merchandise.
Yeah, you have to manufacture. You have to put up a lot of money up front to manufacture all that merchandise. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's interesting. Cause when I look at Udo, last week, like he had a lot of different merchandise and a lot of it was signed and stuff like that. So it was interesting because from my perspective as a fan in that case, I definitely wanted to get something. I was far more likely to spend some money because I knew that I could get something signed.
Yes.
Right there. And it was also really awesome.
We do the same thing. After every show, we finish, we go, we towel off. We compare some notes, we laugh about things, and we get a quick bottle of water, we throw some hand sanitizer on, and we go out there and we shake hands and kiss babies and take photos and sign anything anybody wants to sign. For us, it's kind of, I mean, first of all, we're a very blue-collar, hands-on, down-to-earth kind of band, and so we can't even fathom the thought of doing any kind of a VIP or pay for access type of thing that a lot of bands are doing these days. And we feel that it's going to be a lot more motivational for somebody to pick up, you know, the latest release or an oddball release that we're selling at the merch table and our different t-shirt designs. We usually have 2 different ones every time we go out. We rotate them depending on who's seen the old one and who might buy them. And we sign anything, and you don't even have to buy anything, and we'll still hang out with you and take a picture and sign stuff. We're just not like that. But without the merchandise, you couldn't be out there. So, and I understand. It's like when we go and we play in the UK and Europe, which is predominantly where we tour these days because of logistics and finances and the demand for the band, I got to get stuff made over there. And I can't even ship it back. So you can't even buy merch on our website because I can't get it back from where I have it stored over in the UK and England. Because it's, you know, when you do a decent looking shirt, it's $5-6 a pop. You can't really charge more than 15 or 20 bucks for it. And, you know, you add that up, it's tight, you know. So all these things is what you kind of put together in revenue streams, and they're getting smaller and smaller. And to ask people to come out and buy a ticket and then buy a shirt and then still allow them to have some beverages, you know, it's not a cheap ticket. And dealing with the apathy and the access that people have to just about anything, you can watch HD full live concert of Udo probably somewhere in Canada. And if you know, if you pull that up on YouTube and you have a decent sound system and a big flat screen TV that you could throw it on, you never got that in 1980. You never got that in 1988. It's not possible. And all of that is culturally and socially and commercially killing the music business. Just the nature of the beast. And nobody can really change that. And I don't think it's going to.
Yeah, I mean, my wife and I have such a different viewpoint of live music, period. Like, I love live music, and I've always loved live music. I will go, I would way rather go to the concert, because quite frankly, I mean, you know, if I see Guns N' Roses and Axl Rose screws up the lyrics of Sweet Child of Mine, I'm actually good with that. I think that's great, because that was live. Whereas my wife doesn't actually, she's like, well, I have the album, I don't really need to see them, it's not going to be any different. And I'm like, oh, but it can be different, it's great, it's much better.
Yeah, but answer this question for me. She probably has 20 pairs of black shoes that to you think are pretty much identical.
That's probably right. True. Yes.
So, you know, to her, she thinks you're crazy when you point that out. What are you talking about? This has this little strap with the brass buckle. This one has a wider strap with a silver buckle. This one, the toe is completely different. And you're looking at it going, oh, my God, the woman's got like 20 of the same exact pair of shoes. And you think she's kind of weird. She probably thinks the same thing about you.
Well, and
Brett is kind of weird,
right,
of course.
Yeah. Especially when she sees you wearing them when she's not home.
Like the one with the silver,
it's just you know, you're just shoe curious. That's okay.
You got the legs for it, right?
Well, for sure. It brings out my eyes.
Look here, people. My eyes are here, not down here.
This would be a totally different category for the show.
Yeah. Well, no, but I needed this because you were depressing me there, Ron. I mean, you're talking the truth, but jeez. Oh,
but you know what? Let me give you some hope, because this is what I've been sensing. There is definitely a movement and a resurgence of people who are starting, and I think it's the unfortunate outcome for where we're losing guys like Tom Petty and losing guys like Malcolm Young and losing Prince and losing all of these great, great artists, I think are starting to make people wake up to how they need to be a lot more supportive and a lot more reverent. Now, it's terrible that the fear of losing something, but a lot of times that's what saves relationships, you know? That people are really trying to get out there, and it's in smaller numbers, but they're the passionate few that keep this alive, who are seeking out and supporting all of this stuff, and they're learning about types of music that they never delved into before, because these are the people that remember how important music was in their life. And they remember the social connectivity that comes with music and the like-minded people that rally around this. And I'm seeing a definite uptick and a surge in people showing a reverence for it. So that's hopefully going to continue.
No, it's very interesting. Like, I mean, it's one of those cases where when I think about it, I've always thought, like, to give an example, we had tickets to see James Brown, and he died 2 days before the concert that we were going to go see. And it was one of those cases where it was just like, oh, I mean, how, like, this is awful. I mean, we love James Brown, but it does instill that desire to go see as many people as you can, I guess, in us, before they pass away.
Yeah, No, it's that, and also I think, you know, listen, I'm really grateful that we got together and we just spontaneously put out a record, and there's been a very, very strong and general consensus that it's just a good, fun rock and roll record, and it's entertaining people, and people are, the people that didn't know about us are finding out about us, and the people that know us for a long time are really enjoying the record. It's almost like a breath of fresh air that we just keep kind of making just good straight-ahead rock and roll, and we're really grateful for that on many different levels. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of people out there that are just kind of in the way that, like, cars are nostalgically going back to lines and design that were sort of retro and nostalgic feel because people miss that certain aesthetic. And I think the same thing is going on with music. And I'm not saying it's kids, but I can't relate to kids. I'm not a kid. I don't try to make music for kids. I'm still trying to get to the ZZ Top, AC/DC, Bad Company, Rolling Stones fan that never, ever heard of us. And so that alone is enough to keep me going till the day I die. And if I can get it up to the point where I'm playing in a nice-sized theater rather than a nice-sized club, then great. It gives me something to shoot for, and it's realistic, and it's reasonable, and it's contemporary. But there's a lot of bands that are grumbling about how the music business is dead or rock is dead. And what they're referring to is they can't play arenas and sell them out anymore. And so to them, my attitude is, you know, quit whining, you know? it's like, seriously? Yeah, this isn't 1978. And you're not going to play to an 18,000 seat room. You're going to play to a 9,000 seat room. And you really should be grateful for it. And all things considered, you know, you're doing a better business than most. And you really should make the fans feel like they're going to come out and not see a bunch of cranky old men doing it, you know?
Is there any times that you've had fans approach you and they uplift you or give you something, say something uplifting or you know, give you a story about how some song inspired them or yes, an album is a favorite? Like, what are some of those stories?
All the time. I, you know, it, to me, it's the greatest single honor. It's greater than sales. It's greater than any awards. When somebody comes up, I had like this one guy in Scotland, and he wrote to me on Facebook before we went over there and played. And he wound up coming early, and we wound up meeting him in a pub down the street from the venue. And he just told a story about how his wife was dying from cancer, and their song was In Your Arms from the first record, and he played it at his wedding, and he played it at her funeral, and he was playing it to her when she was passing away in hospice care. And he told us the story with tears coming down his face, and to for something that I've been a part of to weave itself into another human being's life for that long, with that much power and that much significance, is absolutely astounding, and it's incredible to me. And whether I was ever playing in an arena or platinum or yelling that my biscotti was stale and throwing it across the dressing room because I'm some pampered asshole, it doesn't matter who you are, to be able to do what you love to do and have it move somebody in that way and become so important to them in their life is absolutely indescribably powerful and wonderful to me. And I hear it all the time. And you know, that's one of the reasons why we go out every night after the show, because that's when we hear those kind of stories. And these people approach us, and you know, to them, they saw us on MTV and I was larger than life, and they can't believe that they're talking to me. And usually they're like, what happened to your hair? And how come you're so much shorter than I thought you were? And I kind of have to explain that it's like, I'll look like Santa Claus if I keep my hair long. And it's just kind of a pain in my ass, and hair doesn't make the music, blah, blah, blah. And yes, I am only 5'8", but the drummer is 5'4". So I look really big compared. And anyway, then we start getting into the more important questions, and, you know, and you hear these kind of stories, and, you know, it's just incredible because it reminds me the power of music still. you know, when we talk about sales and we talk about this and that story and this personality and this corporation, all these people, man, for whatever reason, music was, it was and is incredibly important to them. And if at some period of time we happen to be the band that they gravitated to the point where now that they're 40-something years old or 50-something years old, that they come down and they waited 25 years and they followed us and they come to see us and they had to just meet us and tell us this story, is absolutely priceless, man. It's just priceless. And it's what keeps us going. And we wind up becoming like good friends. We heard this story, similar story, and then the guy wrote to us and said he's a friend from Germany, that he's getting married out in Las Vegas. Would we come and play his wedding? And we all hopped in a car and drove 4 hours and played acoustic versions of Little Caesar songs while Elvis Presley married him in the back of a Cadillac. You know, and it's like, he's like, really? You would do that? And I'm like, I can't believe you'd want us to come play your damn wedding, dude. I mean, it's... So we did, and we made it a kind of family weekend with us and our wives, and we're close with him, and he comes to every show. He follows us around in Europe, and, you know, for those reasons, music is priceless. The unifying aspect of it, the power that it has to know that something we did has now become a lifelong memory, and two people spending their path together and life's journey together is just absolutely incredible to us. And I hope we never lose, you know, the sensation and the value of that in why we make music or how we treat our fans or how we approach it. Because to me, it's really been really lacking. And I get it. There's a lot of guys who are tired, a lot of guys who are bitter, and a lot of guys who need more revenue. But charging people for pictures or signatures or being cranky at shows, any of that kind of stuff, it's just, it's not doing anybody any good, including their career.
Well, it's definitely, you know, it's so much easier to turn somebody off.
Oh, yeah. Right, I know, God, I've done it with a million women, you know, so, you know. It's like, what? Okay, I thought you were pregnant. That means you're fertile. I don't understand. Why are you so offended? You know? God. You know. Oh,
as that lands. It took a little man, bit, all of that
one,
lands.
Remember, there's one in the next town coming. It's all good. We'll try again tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, you can't win them
all. No, right? No. But at least, at least we got to bat, you know?
That's right.
Oh, awesome.
See, that's such a refreshing way of looking.
It is. Man, I've been turned down by some of the most gorgeous women on the planet, and most guys can't say that, you know.
So, no, I've been turned down by some of the most average women on the planet.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, if you keep striving at it, man, someday you'll be slapped square in the face by like a supermodel. It's great. It's really great.
All right, no names, but
no.
No.
Listen, you know, I got to tell you, like they said, this story in the book. Somebody called me up one day and said, "Dude, do you know that you're in like the second page of Jenna Jameson's autobiography?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" Meanwhile, the first thing my brain says is, "Uh-oh, what the hell? Oh shit! You know, you're going to be in trouble for this." And it turned out that when she was 19, she was a huge fan of Little Caesar. And she talked about how she was getting all dolled up in her nastiest outfit and going down to the Palladium to see Little Caesar play. And all she wanted to do was to meet me. And I read this like 25, 30 years later going, where the hell was I? You know? Like, you know, and meanwhile, I got all these dudes calling me up going, dude, I'm like, I know. Jenna Jameson wanted to sleep with me. And then my next question is, why are you reading Jenna Jameson's autobiography? It's like, dude, you're like 48 years old and married. Really? This is the book you chose to read? You know? It's like, but whatever. Another one of those, you know, feathers in the cap of which I was absolutely no beneficiary other than bragging rights. Great.
But it makes for a great story.
Sure does. You know, when you're sitting around the old age home, it's great. You know, I could have had that girl. It's funny because I tell my wife that all the time. Hey, don't give me any crap because I will go find Jenna Jameson. And she's like, you know, of course, typical women response. Oh, that plastic thing has been, you know, she's like 20 miles of bad road. And she did it like I'm serious, right? Like, I'm really going to look her up and go, hey, remember me? You know, yeah, not going to happen.
Yeah, you mentioned me in your autobiography.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
who are you again?
Yeah. Who?
Oh, that's excellent, though. That's an excellent story.
Yeah, it's fun.
what about, you talk about music videos. What about, like, some, did they ever come to you with some ideas that you just looked at and thought, what the hell is this script or this concept or whatever?
Oh, God, they had this thing of, like, we would be roaming. I remember the first video that we were going to shoot, which, you know, we wound up, our Chain of Fools video, we spent, the budget was $140,000.
Wow.
And all that money was spent on, you know, they shot it on film and there was catering trucks and hair and makeup trailers. And meanwhile, we didn't do any hair. We didn't do any makeup. We were too nervous to even eat. So everybody's eating on our dime. Wow. Somebody okay?
That's a cat.
That's, wow. Yeah. That cat sounds like a take one of your bull mastiffs.
Is he a Siamese?
Nope. He's just.
Is he stuck in the doorway?
No, he's just needy. Oh,
yeah. Brett, we have talked before about your cat on podcasts.
Yeah, Brett does also like
pussy himself.
Yes, listen, I know. And I've got a dog that can cure that real quick. yeah. But anyway, so we shoot this $140,000 video, of which I got no direction. It was Tamara Davis, this film director. But meanwhile, the other concepts we shot down, the one that I remember was they wanted to have us, because of the Caesar reference, be statues. They were going to make statues of us that we were going to break out of. And we're sitting at these meetings with these, you know, we got to remember this is the late 80s. So this is, you know, coming after the Billy Squire videos and the Journey videos of them, just all bad acting and bad storylines. And yeah, they were going to get these statues made that we were going to burst out of and be this triumphant rock band. And we're like, oh my God, this is unbelievably bad. But they entertained them and they would pitch them with such passion and fervor. And you would just kind of sit there and go, well, that's interesting. You
know? That's great. I mean, music videos, it blows the mind to think about how much got spent on music videos. And I'm sure gets spent on the major music videos now. When you're doing music videos at this point, especially on a smaller level, you can shoot it with a cell phone.
Well, that's it. GoPro. Similar. You know, I mean, we're about to shoot another video, and it's like we got somebody with a GoPro shot some footage when we were over in England for live footage of us just mouthing the words a couple times during sound check, and then we're going to do some quick shooting here with a drone and a GoPro and a couple of GoPros, and it's like, you know, $3,000 all in, editing everything, you know. And you got to be, nowadays, you have to be able to do that. And if you can't, then you can't survive out there. You just, there isn't, $140,000 is like, you know, I mean, do the math on that. Do you know how many records you'd have to sell at 15 cents on the dollar, you know, to recoup that, let alone everything else? It's just, on a business level, those things just can't happen anymore. Now, I'm sure if you're Beyonce, it's a whole different story, but, you know.
So how much actually then was the budget for recording that first album? Because I'm sure this one's about the same, I'm guessing, your latest.
Listen. Okay, so a little bit of backstory. We at the time signed the largest record deal ever given to a new artist at the time in 1988. And it was basically pretty much, it was almost like an open-ended, endless supply of money. And so by the time we paid the business manager, by the time we paid Jimmy Iovine, by the time we paid Bob Rock, by the time we paid for the hotel for six guys to be in a suite or an apartment type thing, to be in Vancouver for 6 months, we were $1.1 million in the hole. Yeah, $1.1 million. And you know what the band was getting every week? $300. That's what we were living on. And
each?
We were so
tell me that was each.
We thought we were so cool. We ain't working no jobs, man. We get $300 a week. So meanwhile, that doesn't count the revenue that came in. We got a publishing deal for like $300,000. So Jimmy Iovine takes, you know, $45,000 right off the top of that. The attorney takes, you know, the business manager takes 5% off of that. Then you got to pay taxes. Then you got to pay workman's comp insurance because you've got crew to pay. Then you've got to pay all the other insurance. You've got to pay state taxes because all of it's state and federal taxes because that's all revenue. So, and then we get to pay that back at 15 cents on the dollar. It's the worst deal in history. And the crazy thing is here's the band going, you know, I wouldn't take, go for just the biggest, you know, the biggest check that somebody will give us. We're never going to pay that back. And oh, no. This is the music business, man. You got to take every nickel they give you. Just take it and run. Now, of course, that's the people that make a commission off of that, telling you to do that. But, you know, how are you going to argue with a guy like Jimmy Iovine? You're not going to. You know, this is a guy that I'd sit there waiting to have a meeting with him, and then Bono would walk out of his office, you know? And it's like, how am I going to go in there and tell him to go fuck himself? You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, so that's just the way it was. But yeah, $1.1 million.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah,
that's insane.
And we sat around for 6 months waiting for Bob Rock because him and John Collider had a fight. We were ready to start the record, and we wound up getting in a tour bus and touring with Jane's Addiction, which was a really weird pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, here we are. I mean, it got to the point we were eating acid just to get through the shows. Like, because here we are playing with a band. The singer's got like clown shoes and a ring in his nose and walked around barefoot on a Middle Eastern carpet on stage. And here we are, this biker blues band playing to these kids who like came to see this art band, you know? And it literally got to the point in Virginia. I remember we all dropped acid going, this is the only way we can cope with it. And it was very strange. I remember it snowed that night for the first time in 30 years. And we just stood there grabbing at snowflakes while the while the bus driver was like, get on the bus. And we're like, wow. It's like, yeah, it was kind of a strange pairing. So we wasted money doing that for 6 months. You know, I mean, it was all just, you know, in those days, man, it was just money everywhere. And you know, a lot of different interests and a lot of different agendas and a lot of different egos and power moves and pomp and circumstance. And, you know, and I'm grateful for this to this day because it's still, you know, the core guys in the band and our family that's been together since day one, that none of that was impressive to us. You know, I had somebody wrote me a great thing on Facebook yesterday. I did an interview with this woman that's got a radio show on FM on the East Coast, and it also plays on the UK. And someone wrote in on their Facebook page that they were in an opening band that opened for us in San Francisco, and their grandparents came down. And he was really young. He was like 18 and in a band, and his granddad was really cool, and he rode motorcycles, was really into music. And he wrote this story of how they came down to soundcheck, and they're like, who's those scary guys? And he goes, that's Little Caesar. And like, they're like, oh my God. Yeah, we saw them on MTV. Wow, they're so scary. And the next thing you know, I'm having dinner with them in the club with his grandma and grandpa. And she's calling me honey. And it's like, he remembers this. He's like, you were so cool to my grandparents. And from that day forward, she had a totally different attitude about biker guys and tattooed guys. And she said that she was friends with Ron Young from Little Caesar, the band. They're on MTV. I know him, you know, so, you know. But it's like, I hear stories like that, that back in the day when we could have been complete, you know, a-holes and really thought we were going places and we were rock stars, and now we really made it. Now we don't have to be nice to people or courteous or respectful. We never lost the basic inherent sense that we're nothing, man, until we sell records. And even when you sell records, that shouldn't change anything. That just means you get to do what you love to do on a bigger scale, but it can't ruin you as a human being.
Now, did Did your budget increase for the Influence album when Earl Slick
No.
came in?
See, at that point, we had already... See, this was the other thing I found out was they had dipped into the second recording fund and advance fund when we went $1.1 million on the first one. So all of a sudden, we're staying in L.A. and we're all now down to like $200 a week. And we got to get this thing done. And how do we get in on some budget recording time and blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah. All of a sudden, see, what had happened was when they sold the label right during the release of our first single on the first record, the Japanese owned Geffen. And all of a sudden, you got all these big accountants coming in wanting to know, how come there's 220 bands signed to Geffen Records and only about 18 of them are making money? See, I never knew this when we signed with Geffen, but there were A&R guys with like 32 acts that they signed. And none of them were ever going to see the light of day. There's a famous story of Inga Laurie from the Nymphs, who was working with Tom Zutaut, who signed Guns N' Roses. And the Nymphs were like this cool punk rock kind of band, and Inga was this pretty, arty kind of girl. And Tom would not give them the funds to go in and start their record. And she got so pissed, she jumped up on his desk, and she was wearing a skirt with no panties, and she just started pissing on all his family photographs. And she's like, this is what I think of you. This is what I think of your family. This is what I think of this label. And he started crying. It, like, destroyed him. And it was a famous story. And, of course, everybody bowed to the goddess that was Inga Laurie at that point, because that's the coolest thing you could do. It was completely suicidal, of course, but she realized there was no way she was getting to make a record, and she just had to do something. And that's how frustrating it got for a lot of people, especially at Geffen. You know, there's 200 and something bands. Well, by the second record, they had hired this guy, Robert Smith, who was hired to come in and just say no to everything. No tour support, no video budgets, lower recording funds, cut this band, cut that band. He had to make the numbers crunch so that David could meet his numbers, because he got $2.3 billion or whatever it was for selling Geffen at the time. So these are the things that people don't know. You know, well, what happened to this band or that band, or how come this band didn't, you know, get more of a push? Well, because, you know, I mean, it happened to Junkyard. You know, it's like you come out of the box strong, but at that point, the accountants and the lawyers are running the label. And like with a band like Little Caesar, we came out stronger on the first 3 weeks of the record than the Black Crowes did. We had 120 radio ads the first week. MTV put us immediately into heavy rotation. We had it all laid out for us. And then everything behind the scenes fell apart with the label and the sale and all this sort of stuff. And they were all disappointed. If we were the Black Crowes, if we sold twice as many records in the first 3 weeks as the Black Crowes or twice as much exposure, you would think that they would consider that a great success, especially considering that that band became really huge. But impressions are everything. And expectations are everything. People just thought, because of Jimmy Iovine and John Kalodner and Bob Rock, that it was just going to sell itself. It was just going to magically appear in everybody's record collection. And it just doesn't. Kids don't care, man. They didn't care about the producer. They didn't care about the A&R guy. The music moved them, and they got to hear it, and they got to buy it, or they don't. And if not, they move on to the next band. It's just the way it works.
You know, I know it didn't work out so well, but when you first heard you were going to have Bob Rock, were you excited then?
No.
No, right from the beginning.
No. See, we went through a battle for about 8 months of doing demos with different producers. The guy we wanted was Joe Hardy, that worked with ZZ Top out of Memphis. And we went down to Arden in Memphis, and he got the band. And he did some really great, sleazy, really warm recordings with us. And John Kalodner was like, well, no, we need the big, slick production. That's what's selling these days. And we're like, no, we're not one of those bands. We wanted like Tom Dowd or Ed Stasium or Joe Hardy. We wanted old school 70s, you know, real rock producer that wasn't doing all this slick overdub, big reverb drums kind of production. And it was a big battle between us and Kalodner. And then he was like, I talked about rock and he really wants to do a record with you guys. And he's really into doing like a great, warm, old school, organic kind of record. So we were like, okay, well, if that's the case, then we'll meet with him. So he came down to rehearsal and he listened to us play through the set. Didn't say anything. At the end, he was like, I would love, love to do a record with you guys. And the way I see it is we just get some great sounds. We just get a great performance. He goes, I wouldn't even change many of the arrangements. I think you guys just, we just need to capture what I just heard. And we're like, okay, we're good with Bob. If that's his attitude, we're good with Bob. And we got up there and we started recording. And about 3 weeks into the record, Dr. Feelgood went to number one. And all of a sudden, everything changed. 64-track digital machines kept rolling in, and he kept doing more and more overdubs. And the next thing you know, it went from us making a Caesar record to us making a Bob Rock record. And I was calling down to L.A., you guys better get up here and listen to this, because this is going off the rails quickly. And John was just like, nah, listen to Bob. He knows. He's got a number one record. You got to listen to that. And we're like, we're not Motley Crue. We're not Motley Crue, you know. But they don't listen. How are you going to tell John Kolodner, Bob Rock, David Geffen that they don't know what they're doing? But, you know, listen, that's that's just the way it is. But meanwhile, I got 220 other bands on the label that they're screwing into the ground. So, you know, on average, their track record is really not that good. They only want to take credit for the Nelsons and the Guns N' Roses and the Nirvanas. But, you know, the other bands that didn't go huge, they downplay. They want to take their names off those records because, you know, it's about them more than it is the band or even the label.
I never thought of it that way before, you know?
Yeah. It's you know, and the funny thing is we were up there preaching, you know, because even then, like when we did the second record, you know, we were trying to even get that to be really stripped down. At that point, we knew it was over. They were just fulfilling the contract. But, you know, we were sitting there, and I remember going back to the label going, okay, well, you buried our first record. You screwed the pooch on that one. The whole label fell apart. You fired, you know, the label manager got fired, and the whole thing with the records being in the warehouse and the sale, that killed us. So now you want us to do another record. So we'll try this again. I mean, we're kind of bitter and kind of angry, you know, but we'll put our game face on and we'll go to the plate one more time. And, you know, the funny thing is, it's like, I'm just going, hey, can we have a discussion about something? Remember I was telling you the music was had to change. You couldn't keep putting out these fluffy overproduced records. Well, listen to this one. This is a band called Soundgarden. This is your own band called Nirvana. Here's another band called, you know, Mother Love Bone. Here's another band. Notice that all these bands are going huge right now. Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots, all of these bands are emerging. And this is what we told you 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that these kind of records are going to go. So can you finally get out of our way and let us do what it is you hired us to do? Be the curators and purveyors of our own art. At that point, they were so... You know, everything. Everybody was gone. Jimmy was gone. They were, the label was sold. It was like contractual obligation time. They had no intention of promoting it. So it was really too little too late.
You know, wow. Yeah, there's so much to kind of unpack there. But one of the things is, I mean, you did his latest album. I mean, I'm sure he didn't spend $1.1 million. One of the things we see, and it sounds great, and it's a great album, and you know, you're getting your, you know, the production sounds great, and you talk about it, you know, everybody's giving it good reviews, and that, this and that, and one of the things we've seen is not only bands doing a lot of, you know, playing an album front to back, but re-recording an old album, an original album, and we've seen bands redo it with a new singer, or just do them the way they wanted them done. Have you guys thought about doing that with the first album?
No. We're too busy trying to look forward. You know, all of this stuff, people have been hearing these stories and all this stuff for so long, and it's like, it's funny because we're more comfortable with it than a lot of other people. You know, I tell these stories, and a lot of guys could be really bitter or angry as if they're, and I hope that's not coming across that way when I tell all these negative stories. We are where we are, and we're really grateful for all of that. We learned a lot of really, really good lessons. And at the end of it, we still get to make music, and we're still the core and true to the band, and we get to make the kind of records we want, because even all the turmoil in the music business, there's actually a good side to that turmoil that we kind of benefit from by being able to be self-sufficient. And, you know, to go in, like, the latest record, we did in 22 days, and it wasn't even full days because guys had to work. We were in there from 5 o'clock at night to like 11, 11:30 before we're too tired to keep making music. And 22 days, man, the way the Bad Company used to make a record or the Stones used to make a record. And you know what? It's a point of pride with me because there's a lot of bands that can't do that. They need to throw it all in auto-tune and quantize it and let the computers fix it and send the files off to another guy in another city. And, you know, so to just get in a room and make music and try to capture that, and we're finally, after 7 attempts, learning how to do that and get the kind of sound that we want and get the kind of vibe that we want doing it. And, you know, you talk about $1.1 million. You know, there's a record label called Frontiers that's out there, and they have all of these bands from the 80s on them. And they approached us about doing this record for them. And we met with them around the NAMM show here in L.A., and they offered us a real paltry amount of money to get it recorded. And at the end of the day, I just said, you know, first of all, to be honest, nothing wrong with all these other hair metal type bands from LA in the 80s. We're from LA in the 80s, but we've been trying to distance ourselves from that style of music because we're not that style of music since we came out. So I wouldn't want to get into a roster with 25 other bands that make that. And the main reason why I passed on the offer was because they wanted us to make a record that sounded like the first record. And I'm like, are you going to give me $1.1 million? I don't think you're going to. And quite honestly, I think that's a dated record. I don't want to make a dated record. If I'm going to make a dated record, I'd rather make a record that sounds like it's from 1978 or 1979 or 74 than I would ever want to do one from 84 or 88. I just, those records didn't move me. There wasn't enough personality in those records. All the personality was produced out of those records, and a lot of which was because the guys really couldn't play. They could look good, and they had a catchy song or two, and that was good enough for the label. And they got a record deal, and they put out a record. And, you know, I'm not going to name any names, but there's a very famous producer that I asked him, you know, what's it like working with this band that sold 14 million records? And he's like, well, you know the bass player? I'm like, yeah. He's like, a chimp could play his parts, you know? And it's like, it's like, wow, this is coming from Bruce Fairburn, you know, one of the best producers out there. And, you know, to hear this coming from the guy that's supposed to curate the music and make something into it that is just doing it because they know it's going to sell records, but he can't really stomach it as an artistic endeavor, it's, to me, was very, very indicative of there's something wrong going on in music, you know? This shouldn't be the case. Because that wasn't the case in the 70s, man. You look at Zeppelin, you look at Free, you look at Bad Company, you look at Black Sabbath. Every one of those guys could play. And they could record. And they didn't need a computer. And they didn't need a million overdubs. And they didn't need hairspray or makeup to transfer their music to an audience.
This reminds me, Brett, about that story, you know, about Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine.
Oh, he's great.
yeah, in one of the... Because we actually read a lot about of stories and the backstories of hard rock and the like, he told a story where he was on the phone about doing a, you know, to try to get a guitarist gig in a band, and they were like, "So, tell me about your hair,
oh, dude." The same I met. Check this out. In 1987. I met with a guy looking to put a band together at Cantor's Deli, famous deli here in Los Angeles on Fairfax.
Yep.
And the guy's name was Slash. And I sat down with him, and he's got his little Steven Tyler tattoo on his arm, and he's got his hair, and he wasn't wearing his hat, but he had his shades on. He's like, yeah, man, looking to do like a real bluesy kind of soulful hard rock thing. And you know, you sent me that cassette, and I really like what you did. And but now meeting you, man, your hair isn't long enough. So, hey, what? thanks for answering my ad, and I wish you all the luck in the world. And I pointed that out to him when I was working with him when I was going to sing on his solo record, and I got nixed off of that because at the end of the day, I said, I can't sing like Axl. And I know that when you go out to do shows every night, you're going to have to play Sweet Child of Mine and Welcome to the Jungle and Mr. Brownstone and all that. And I can't sing like that guy. His range is higher, and he's got a totally different tone quality, and I won't be able to pull that off. No offense to Axl, he does what he does, and I do what I do, But and he goes, you know what? You're totally right. And he said, this isn't going to work. And he went with the guy from Jellyfish because that guy could go out there and his you know voice was closer to doing the Guns N' Roses hit and singing the Slash stuff, and that was going to make Geffen much happier. You know, plus Geffen didn't want me in another fucking band at the end. It's like, oh, that guy? Oh God, you got to be kidding! We can't get rid of this idiot, you know. So, you know, but yeah, I have the same exact kind of story. Didn't get the gig because my hair wasn't long enough. I'm like, you know, in 6 months, dude, I'll be fine. You know, it's not like I'm bald. It's just down. It's just down to my shoulder. You know, I mean, it's like, yeah, turn down because of my hair. That's,
well, I think Tom Morello might have had like being bald.
Yeah, could be like shaving his head.
But that guy kills. I mean,
I know. Man.
But they didn't even ask how well he plays. All they cared about was his hair. No, they didn't even
get to it. The big joke in L.A. like there used to be this music mag in L.A. called Rock City News, and it was just a whole bunch of fans that acted like reporters, and it came out like twice a month, and it was always. You know, it was like a little bit of color, mostly black and white. It was just, you know, like a newspaper on the LA scene, which was very healthy and thriving. So, but every review was like, you know, we went and saw, you know, whatever, God's Hairdo or, you know, Glorious Toys or whatever the hell the band name was. And they were really great when they got on stage. They were flinging their hair around and it looked so good and the singer so cute. And then you read the next one and the band was so, the singer's hair was flowing around and it was like hysterical. Everything was like, how well did you flip your hair? You know, how tall was your hair? What was your outfit looking like? They never ever talked about the music. It was always, you know, who's just looking more outrageous or who's got the tallest hair or, you know, how good his makeup was. It was really kind of strange.
Oh, crazy, crazy. Do you want to hear the bit I got for you here?
Sure.
Like I said, I came up with a little bit. It's based on the idea of adding roadies and hookers. Cause Brett said that to me, he started throwing, you know, roadies and hookers into, just about everything. Didn't you, Brett?
You could take Shakespeare. Yeah. And start pulling out keywords and putting roadie and hooker. And
exactly,
it gets you looked at odd at work, but that's okay.
And you know, and then there's that old saying, you know, that you can take any fortune cookie, and you can, you know, as long as you put in bed at the end, it works out. And I thought you could probably do that with fortune cookies, roadies, and hookers. So here we go. I got a few here for you. Tell me what you think of these.
Okay.
Okay, a friend asks only for your time, not your money, becomes a friend asks only for your hooker and not your roadie.
Good. I can vouch for that. That sounds like a true friend. they know what line to never cross.
The man or woman you desire feels the same about you. The roadie or hooker you desire feels the same about you.
Yes, they both handle your equipment.
Oh, there you go.
For a fee.
For a fee, yeah.
The love of your life is stepping into your planet this summer becomes the roadie of your life is stepping into your hooker this summer.
There you go. See, it's amazing. The universal wisdom that comes from roadies and hookers. there is a sort of... It's funny because the litany of crew guys that we've had that have worked with the band that years later, I hear all these stories of all the fun and exploits they had while I was busy doing an interview or the complete and utter debauchery that they were doing in the back of the tour bus or in the equipment truck even. With the girls that we were all, hey, what happened to that really cute one that was in the front row? She's with the crew. And to the point where we had this guy, Mikey. Mikey was like 5'2", and he was the drum tech. And when we were up in Canada for 6 months, we basically lived at the Peeler bars, because while Bob Rock was being anal over tuning or a drum part, the rest of us were hanging out at the Orange and the Number Five or the Cecil or the Drake, throwing money at these beautiful girls. Well, Mikey comes and tells us that he's in love with this stripper who's got a twin sister, by the way, identical twin. And I can't tell you what it's like watching two girls identical take their clothes off and soap each other up. But that's a complete that's a complete other topic. So Mikey tells us that he's, you know, he's been seeing this girl for 2 months on the side and he's going to get married. And we're like sitting him down having the Mikey, you never marry a stripper, dude. Never. Well, it turns out that this girl is a financial, she's a finance major in college. She's got a financial planner and an investment banker. She's got over $600,000 in the bank. She had an exit plan, and he married her. And he was with her for like 5 years. And she wound up becoming like a multimillionaire, all from peeling her clothes off with her sister up at the lumberjack camps up in British Columbia. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like this weird sort of, you know, exercise. And you know, never judge a book by its cover, because this girl was exactly what they all say they're going to do, but never do. And not to mention the fact that she was absolutely stunning, drop dead gorgeous. And she was like 5'10 and he was 5'2. It was really kind of hysterical. But we wound up becoming very jealous, you know.
I would.
Yeah.
I was considering doing that too, but I don't have a twin and Brett doesn't look anything like me.
No, and you know what? I can't soap my ass in public. No. I just got this. I have this thing, and it really kind of dampened my stripping career.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also picking up dollar bills that have germs on them and stuff and putting them in my underwear. I don't know.
We're it's in Canada. Little... We got those dollar coins.
Yeah, the loonies and the toonies.
Those
pop into small orifices like yes. change purses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing you want. Right?
Yeah, to be a human change purse. Yeah.
I got a couple more here. I got a couple good ones coming up.
Okay. All right, cool.
If winter comes, can spring be far behind? Would be if hooker comes, can roadie be far behind?
No, exactly. Someone's got to clean up the mess.
A stranger is a friend you have not spoken to yet. Is a hooker is a roadie you have not spoken to yet?
Yeah. Again, is that equipment thing? Paying them to move your equipment around.
Your ability for accomplishment will follow with success. Is your ability for roadies will follow with hookers?
Yeah, no, this is the story of many bands' careers, strippers, actually. Yeah.
And probably my last one, my favorite one, is nothing astonishes men so much as common sense and plain dealing becomes nothing astonishes men so much as roadies and hookers.
Yes, this is true.
Actually, I do have one more.
Okay.
It's amazing how much good you can do if you don't care who gets the credit becomes it's amazing how much hookers you can do if you don't care who gets the roadies.
Right. It's all words of wisdom.
I think that we need to go into, I think that the problem is, I know how we can make the money we want to make. We need to make these fortune cookies with roadies and hookers in them and start distributing them to restaurants. I think, you know, weddings. No,
you know, well, you know those businesses like where they have like the topless maid services?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that we have women, attractive women that move and set up equipment and service the guys in the band as well. because then, you know, the guys like Gene Simmons and everything, it's like a one-stop shop. Yes. It's a one-stop yeah. shop. And you know, it's like, you know, be the Jeff Bezos of sexual exploit and equipment cartage all rolled into one. You know, it's, you know, this one is a guitar tech and does Greek. You know, I mean, it's like just the resume alone would be incredibly entertaining to put together.
And if we could get to the point where we're making $107 million a day, then we wouldn't have to worry about anything else.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. You know, it's, you know, we are talking mostly about sex trafficking, which is really frowned upon by most people other than the Ben in this conversation. What? I don't see any problem with, you know, this is consensual equipment moving. You know,
like, yeah, exactly.
Like, because you know, it's still equipment moving.
I didn't force that chick to lift that Ampeg SVT. She did it happily for a fee. This is commerce.
Exactly. Look, you're paying. You're just paying for the equipment moving. Whatever else happens, happens.
You're paying for them to leave once they load it in the truck.
Yeah,
and that works for both the roadies and the hookers.
Yeah, you it's know, 1992. Do you know where your roadie
truck
is?
Truck is just a euphemism. So, you know, it's fantastic. Funny. This last story you talk about, like, just the difference in attitude. I had a friend, musician, was working for a moving company to pay his bills, and one day he gets a phone call, and it turns out he's moving Gene Simmons from one house to another, and. So he's like all excited, and on his break, he's calling people, and he calls me up. He's like, dude, you ever gonna believe? I'm like, oh, well, say hi. You know, we toured with him. He's kind of a dick. And he's like, no, man, he's really cool. This is great. I'm like, okay, great. So at the end of the day, he calls me because you're not going to believe this, man. I'm like, what? He goes, well, at the end, I went up to him, and I said, Mr. Simmons, I got to tell you what an honor it was moving all your gold records. And he goes, and he steps back. He goes, gold? Get the hell out of my house. Those were platinum records, asshole. When you learn the difference, you can come back and move them again. And it's like, wow. You can't just go, thanks.
You know?
But even to that level, he is so anal retentive and precise about getting credit where credit is due and sales and commerce that... You know, for a man that says that he's never taken a vacation in his life, he's never done a drug in his life, it's all about the commerce and the business. I mean, he used to come backstage and tell us, a good show isn't when you guys hit a great pocket. And a great show is when the pyro and the lights go off right at the same time in the right spot. That's a good show. And a good show is when you get more people to buy T-shirts. That's a good show. And we were like going, okay, well, I guess that's not why we're out here, you know. And he's like, well, you got a lot to learn, you know. And so, you know, that's the guy that's saying the music business is dead. So, again, it's all relative.
He is a special
individual. He is, man. He really is. And you know what? There's actually parts of him that are quite endearing. But, you know, we jammed with him one night at this little club. We had a day off. We were in Rochester, New York, and right next to the hotel, there was just this little bar that had this cover band. And he went in there and just hung out. And he's like, you guys want to jam? And we got up and we did all these great old rock songs, Beach Boys and Stones and Beatles and Motown. And he knew every one of them. He's got a vast musical knowledge, and he's actually quite a versatile player. And I'd never seen him that easygoing and smiling and laughing like he didn't have a care in the world. And I wanted to go up and go, you're such a lying sack of shit. The music means so much to you. It's so obvious how much it means to you. And you just don't want it. Because he says, I'm not a musician. I'm an entertainer. Don't even confuse the two. And it was just kind of funny because he's painted himself into this caricature. But, you know, when given the opportunity... You know, it kind of shows through just how knowledgeable and reverent and how much music really does mean to him, even when he tries to deny it, you know, so it's interesting.
No, I totally think that's true. I mean, we saw him last year at the Comic Expo in Edmonton, and he performed a concert, but the first song... I was up in the media pit, but and I couldn't tell. But apparently, the first song was horribly out of tune, and he totally stopped it. Wouldn't go on until it got back into tune. And I pictured it like, man, oh man, you know, like if Gene Simmons only cared about the show, then he wouldn't have cared.
Yeah. If do you have time for another funny Gene Simmons story?
Always.
Oh,
always.
Absolutely.
Well, when we were out with him, you know, he lets the opening band get one sound check, the beginning of the tour, and then you never get another one, even though there's plenty of time. It just, he doesn't allow it. It's like a rite of passage. Well, at the time, my buddy Gary Corbett was playing backstage keyboards, and he was doubling all of Paul's rhythm parts and all the chorus vocals. He had them sampled on a keyboard. So when it was lick it up, it was all this big, perfectly. It wasn't like perfect. They had them a little, just slightly loose so that it felt real, but it was powerful and strong and multiple voices every night. And then Gary would double all of Paul's chords while he was jumping around doing his thing. So when they would sound check, Gene would never say, I want you to turn up the samples, because he didn't want anybody to know he was using samples. So he would say, turn up the keyboards, or he would say, turn up the vocals, meaning the vocal sample, but they had a new monitor engineer. And the monitor engineer every day was wearing the same outfit. It was like this NASCAR jacket with all of these patches on it. And I'm like, well, he must be Southern or something. He's really into his NASCAR. He's like, he looks like he's on a NASCAR team. And every time Gene would ask for something, he'd raise his hand, you know, like he's praising to God or something. And I'm like, wow, this guy's really a character. So after about 3-4 nights, Gene is starting to get more comfortable. And he's starting to scream out these things, and he's calling out the wrong thing. And Gene goes up and rips into him and fires him. So, he doesn't. He rips into him, and the guy, what he did was he left the airport. But the reason that he had that NASCAR outfit on was he had this cardboard cutout that he got from AutoZone of a NASCAR driver with his hand up, and he put that behind the console. So when Gene's yelling at him, the guy's halfway to the airport already, and there's the guy in the NASCAR outfit with his hand up, and Gene's yelling at him. Yelling at him. And I'm on the other side of the stage going, the guy's not moving. And Gene's like screaming. He's like running over and just leaning over. And, da, 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 screaming. And he backs up and he goes back to singing. And he goes, and he's getting madder and madder and madder. And the guy's just there. The guy knew he was going to get fired. And he brought this cardboard cutout. And he bought the NASCAR outfit just to do that to Gene. It was absolutely brilliant.
That's like the best Spinal Tap moment ever.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And the guy came back and I went up and we all bowed to him. And I'm like, dude, he's like, no, man. You know, when they offered me the job, they told me, this is like Vietnam. Don't get close to anybody because you don't know how long you're going to last. The guy is notorious for firing people. So he was like, I just can picture he's going to yell at me with about all this stuff. And I just saw this guy standing over there and then, you know, at the AutoZone, and then right in the corner, they were selling the same jacket. You know, it was like Rusty Wallace or something. And you could buy a Rusty Wallace jacket and a Rusty Wallace hat. And he goes, so I just bought it and I gave the guy $20 and he let me take the cardboard cutout. And when they picked me up, I threw it in the back with the equipment. And every night I was just waiting for him to fire me or yell at me or be abusive to me. And I'd run back out to the equipment truck, get it, stick behind the monitor, get in the cab, and leave. And that's exactly what he did. It was absolutely brilliant. And, of course, Gene sent somebody out to the airport to get him, and he apologized. And, you know, he wound up sticking on the tour. But he sure taught him a lesson. It was absolutely brilliant. It was brilliant. Awesome.
That's classic.
That's fantastic. That's a fantastic story. Well, Ron, this has been awesome. This one, the other one, just great.
Fun talking with you guys. Man, it's been a pleasure and an honor.
You know, the pleasure and honor is all ours. You should now plug your shit because 8 is out. Little Caesar.
Yes, Little Caesar has a new album. Please check it out. It's just good, straight ahead blues based, honest rock and roll. If that's the kind of stuff that you like, then please stream it for free and take money out of my mouth. I'm totally okay with that. Whatever it is. Listen to it. Get to know who we are. We're honest. We're sincere. And we're grateful for any you know, listening or patronage or association with us. You'll never feel like you've been taken advantage of by a band like us. So If you know who we are, thank you for your support. If you don't, check us out. And thank you to guys like you who keep our music going and keep my stupid persona alive out there in the real world.
Oh, you're tremendous, Rob.
We love doing it.
Yeah, that was...
This is, you know, for us, this is one of the great things that we get to do. We get to go out, we get to help you promote your stuff, and we get to talk to you and hear all the great stories. And hey, I mean, it's all worth it.
Well, good. I'm glad it's rewarding for you. You got to do what you love. You do.
That's right.
Do what you love.
Well, thank you, Ron. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, and
yes. Best of luck to you in the future, and we hope to have you on again.
I look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Take care. A lot. You too.
Bye.
Good luck on the
farm. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.